Americans. One of the most controversial aspects of the UFO controversy has to do with alien abduction, and specifically the entities themselves. What are they? What do they represent? Where do they come from? And how is it that they have access to human subjects across the globe, documented in thousands of case studies presented over a very long period of time? My guests today on the program are Nigel Koerner, the author of Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, along with his collaborators, Dr. Andrew Silverman and Professor John Biggerstaff, in a transatlantic teleconference. This is a two-part presentation of Exotica. Today we're going to go into the background of Nigel's own journey into understanding the UFO ET phenomena, and we're going to go very deep into some topics that may on the surface appear to be unrelated, but actually set the stage for you understanding who these entities are, why they're here, and what they're after. I think for the listeners of this show, this may be one of those benchmark studies. The book again is Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, and the website is nigelkoerner.com, and with that we are going to go to our interview.
Hi there, this is Nigel talking to you all from London, in England. Well, just outside London in England, actually.
Yeah, Randy, what I thought we'd do, like each of you, maybe in turn, starting with you, Nigel, how you got started and what has prompted you to dig so deeply into the research of this phenomena.
Yeah, well, actually it all started accidentally. I keep telling the story on the radio broadcasts all over the world, but it's rather romantic thing. Which happened some years ago when my young son, Darren, was 12 years old, and I was in the middle of some kind of dissertation completely unrelated to the subject of UFOs, when he came up to me and asked me, you know, are UFOs real, Dad? Is this subject actually tangible, real, or is it some thing that's got up by the imagination and so on? And I was, rather... in a sense, I was rather annoyed at the question because I was an absolutely firm skeptic about such things. But Darren's fairly well hitched up in terms of his brain cells and so on, and I expected an embarrassing riposte from him sometime if I gave him a frivolous answer. And I thought I'd better research the thing because I had no idea what the thing was. I'd obviously heard about, you know, we've all gone through the old comic book stage and the Buck Rogers business, and we all love reminiscing about all the space stories and Star Wars and such like and so on. But, I mean, all of that was just, as I said, comic book stuff, and it wasn't something that I took seriously because I'm kind of soaked in the etiology, if you like, of science and so on. So I decided to have a look at this with a little bit more of a serious eye, so to speak, and looked at the thing as much as I could so that I could kind of parry his questions if he asked them and so on. Well, it took me something like over 30 years, shall we say, in all, to give him his answer. And I tell you, when that happened, this entire question through my researches, it got more and more serious, and I had to look at the thing. You know, I thought there was nothing frivolous about this, and so on as I went along. And when I connected up the dots, I had before me a story that actually blew my head off, and it really completely turned my views upside down, and to this day, in fact, it was a life-changing business, and it kind of, you know, motivated me to get this whole thing down on paper, because I wanted the answer I was giving to my son and my children to be something that maybe could be put in front of all parents in the world, because it seemed to me, from what I discovered, that this is something that every single human being on the earth ought to really take seriously. It was a completely new look at the entire existential scale as we understand it, and so on, from the birth of the universe and the whole business that connects up through science and religion and spirituality, as you might put it, and so on. And that's how the whole thing happened. It was a kind of accidental, partly romantic basis that the whole thing happened. And of course, it was something that, as I say, in terms of its impact on me, in fact, changed my career, if you see what I'm trying to say. And It was that profound. What I was discovering was that profound. As I said, I came at it as a really rigid skeptic about it all, and I have to tell you, I have completely revised my view about this, and I find that this whole business of UFOs and all of that is probably, as I said, one of the most serious, if not the most serious question that anyone can posture in the world today. And that's how I came at it. But we've had many discussions between friends of mine who have, you know, all of them soaked in science. We seem to be kind of, you know, soaked in the broth of science, so to speak. And Dr. Silverman's old time compadre of mine many years back, and so is John Biggerstaff, and we went our separate ways in many ways from the original stance we were taking, discussing and arguing about UFOs and what they meant and so on. And as the research came in and we got really teamed up into a really serious outlook on this, we have discussed this thing six ways to Sunday, so to speak, and we now think we can put together something that's quite interesting for people at least to consider. You don't have to believe it. You just put it in front of you, and that's why I wrote the books. And it's taken me three books, in fact, to actually complete the story. The first two I have released. The last one was published in January. That's the one done by the American publisher Bear & Company, Inner Traditions, which are a very respected publisher in world terms today. And of course, the first one was also published by a very respected publisher in Britain, Hodder & Stoughton. And the third one is off the press, so to speak, ready to go when all the trouble and all the mischief I've created with the second book dies down. Some people tell me that it'll take a long time, but well, life is interesting if you see what I'm trying to say. It's not boring in that sense. So. Let's hope that somehow we can get a nice, rather interesting story for you this morning.
Your background is in biomedical science and human behavioral psychology. Is that correct?
And, yeah. Immensely useful.
yes, I would say so, given the thesis that you've broken out in this book. Maybe what we could do is introduce Dr. Andrew Silverman at this point, and maybe Dr. Silverman, could you give us a little bit of background on your work in this area?
Certainly, yes. Well, I'm always fascinated with anything that can help extend my understanding and knowledge a bit further into the world and the universe and humanity and what it all means. And to me, the existence of these so-called unidentified flying objects, there's been so many reports by such people with so much experience of knowing what they're looking at, such as pilots and astronauts and so on, as was shown at the recent press club conference. And so for me, it's not really a question as to whether they exist. What fascinates me is why if they have such an immense technology that's probably tens of thousands of years in advance of our own, what their interest is with us here on this planet. And what I'm most fascinated by is in the nature of what a human being is, such that something that is so far beyond us to compare us against cavemen is probably less of a differential than to compare them against us. There must be something really important that they're interested in.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, Dr. Silverman, you're somewhere in the Pacific Rim, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct, yeah.
Yeah, so because we have a little bit of latency on the recording on the Skype signal today, but that's fine. You're coming in very clear. And we'll introduce also Professor John Biggerstaff, who I believe is somewhat closer to me in Tennessee, so at least we're both on the eastern seaboard of the United States. And
yes, it's a nice day here.
Yes, it's beautiful here, too. I'm actually in southern central Pennsylvania, and it's a bit cold, but right. It's clear.
Yeah.
Professor Biggerstaff, can you give us a little bit of your background and how you were also drawn into this topic?
Well, since I was very young, I always wanted to understand how cells work, and you know, I studied this when I was young, and I ended up with sort of degrees in it, and now I sort of teach these subjects at university and do research. When I came across Nigel and Andrew, really, and we started having these conversations many years ago, I got very interested in this idea of the UFOs. I mean, I'd seen lots of programs on TV, etc., and it really did interest me that there were so many similar reports about these things, you know, from very reputable people, even from just my experience. And Nigel did much, much more research into this. And I became interested not only in the UFOs and what are the aliens doing, essentially, which I think we're going to talk about, but really, you know, there's this growing feeling and understanding that there is a there's been a genetic interception in some way that these aliens are performing upon us. And being a biochemist and a cell biologist, I became interested and said, okay, well, and I read Nigel's first book, you know, when he showed it to me. And I got very interested in, well, how are they doing this? You know, what sort of genetics are we talking about? And so I got involved in really trying to research how this type of effect occurs in biology. And another thing which I think we'll get to by the end of our conversation here is that both Nigel and Andrew and myself to an extent have become interested in things like, and you'll see how this connects, the Shroud of Turin later on. And, you know, what this man in Jerusalem, Jesus, actually may have done to generate this shroud by effectively removing his body, essentially, from the universe. And being a cell biologist, I became very interested as well, how is it possible for a living system to be able to do such a thing? And, you know, over our conversations and with the second book, and now you know, I'm sort of helping a little bit with the third book, We're coming to some ideas about how that actually may be possible. So this is how I sort of got involved in it, really, as from the cell biologist point of view, but really to widen the scope further to other aspects of it that you're going to hear about now.
Yeah, on the face of it, Randy, it seems a very bizarre connection, doesn't it, to say something that, like a soul is connected to UFOs and so on. And as you look at it, you know, in kind of two dimensions or whatever. And the really important thing is the surprise that this gave me as we went along, simply connecting up the dots as logically and as minimalistically as we possibly could, in terms of one step to another and so on. And if I can say this much, science and scientists are at the cutting, and those ones that are at the cutting edge of cosmology and theoretical physics, are happy, you know, to admit that their knowledge of how the universe and all that is in it and came to be in it is almost non-existent. In fact, what they're arriving at is so, it seems so ridiculous that it actually demands, it cries out for an explanation. They are forced, you know, by the data derived from their own observations of the universe to bring into the standard model kind of thing of explanation exotic elements such as dark matter, dark energy. And the new kid on the block is dark flow. That's the latest one. And these are all called dark for a very good reason. Scientists are completely in the dark as to what they are. So to all intents and purposes, they do not exist in the observable universe. And they're now feverishly trying to affirm these things, you know, and verify them and so on. Yet if scientists are to make sense of what they can observe in the observable universe, they have to exist somehow, somewhere, you see. So could this, perish the thought, imply that there is indeed a reality beyond the physically observable that interacts with the physically observable, so to speak? Could this imply something non-physical that might be, for want of a better word, termed God? And then you get into the religious scope, if you see what I mean. So what does it mean to speak of, shall we say, a quantum reality as distinct from an ordinary reality? So classical physics, you know, operates according to laws which dependably explain how reality as we experience it actually works. But at the quantum atomic subatomic level, these laws seem to break down, resulting, you know, in bizarre phenomena that scientists are only beginning to understand now. And we've got this new thing called quantum entanglement, for example. It occurs when two distinct shall we say, particles are observed affecting each other from far away, apparently instantaneously. Einstein called this kind of thing just spooky action at a distance, you know. And results from nearly a century, you know, of quantum experiments profoundly challenge our commonsensical notions of reality and, in turn, pose dramatic philosophical questions about the fabric of space-time, even the nature of truth itself, you know? So quantum theory is currently enjoying a season of a fertile growth, shall we say, you know? And that's the kind of challenge that I faced when I looked into the simple question my son asked me. It went into all these exotic regions of science, scientific investigation, albeit empirical, but it turned up that you could not explain the empirical unless you allowed for something beyond it. And that's the thing that science itself cannot stand to face, you know. They just don't want to bring anything God into it. And neither do I, by the way. Let me tell you here and now that I'm not a religious person. Somebody, you know, I often say this, somebody splashed some water on me when I was a baby and called me a Roman Catholic. And I and Dr. Silverman is Jewish, and we're still trying to decide what category of belief John Biggerstaff is following. And that's one of the fascinating things in my life, is chasing up what John actually believes of something beyond the atom. But we'll get there sometime. And the point is that we all got together in an exciting conflict. I think Dr. Silverman wants to come in here.
Yeah, well, actually, I was just going to say about on the subject of quantum theory, of course, one of the first founders of quantum theory, Erwin Schrödinger, who many listeners may know about the anecdote about Schrödinger's cat. I won't go into too much details, but it's all out there on the internet for anyone who wants to look it up. Well, I mean, he could follow from what they found on their experiments and so on, that actually the universe or any quantum particle or any physical thing actually fundamentally depends on conscious observers in order to make it real.
Yes.
And not just, you know, that an electron, until it's observed, is just a possibility. It's just a probability wave that could be anywhere or nowhere or somewhere. And then the act of conscious observation makes it real. And he actually drew some very fascinating conclusions from this that suggests that actually the fundamental nature of existence, of reality, is far closer to the sentient mind than to a concrete object. And if you look at the nature of space and time and matter and so on, that we talk about this idea of time, but actually we have this concept that time is flowing. But how is it flowing? How can you have 1 second per second and so on? It's all based upon the fact that we have sentience, consciousness, so that we experience something we call now. And according to the equations, there doesn't need to be a now. Everything from the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang, to the heat death could all be at once all together. But yet, we don't experience it like that. We have a now. And what Schrödinger said is that the reason for that is that time is actually the result of the existence of the conscious observer. There would be no time without us. And he also said, if time is dependent on conscious observers in order to exist, then conscious observers cannot begin or end in time. Something that the mind has created, i.e. time, cannot itself destroy the mind. And this actual founder of quantum theory concluded from this that, therefore, anything that has a mind must be eternal. And the fact that we have this concept or experience that throughout our lives we make decisions, we have something that we call free will. Well, the simplest explanation that he could come up with for us having that experience is that we actually do. Now, if we actually have free will, then we have to be able to make a decision where we could have chosen something else despite all of the forces and everything that were acting upon us at the time. That implies that our whole concept of what the physical universe is has to be reconsidered, because we are actually able to harness what philosophers call a prime cause. We can start something, a process, a sequence of events, without having to do so. And this is something that I'll be hopefully returning to a little bit later.
Yeah. And to actually take Andrew's point a little further, if proven true, of course, quantum information theory would kind of dramatically blur, if not collapse, the distinction between immaterial ideas as such, you know, and material reality. Quantum mechanics seems to be telling us that information may not be just a representation of reality as such, Randy, but maybe, in some sense, reality itself. This is a startling, awesome, you know, thing that comes out of it. If this turns out to be the case, this could have a very significant impact on our philosophical framework. It would somehow bring together a sense of unity in our understanding of reality, and that will bring in all the things that people in the science sector don't like to talk about because they cannot empirically prove it, things that are spiritual, things that are ephemeral, that are abstract, but are powerfully the driving force behind all that is physically real, if you see what I'm trying to say. So the basic momentums that govern our universe, you know, according to the laws of physics, involve breakdown. And that is the big deal here. Breakdown and decay through the second law of thermodynamics. And I tell you what, every single person out there who knows anything about physics or whatever will have come across the second law of thermodynamics, which states that all things that are atomic and are enforced break down into states of randomness and chaos with time in their arrangements, in every particle that's composed of them. In other words, to underline it, the universe is rotting. It's one way. Now, that's the big conundrum. Why is it one way when everything we know within it can have a duality? In fact, everything that can run, that can even get a sense of what Andrew's calling time, has to be a duality between two points to flow from one to another. So, in fact, we have a yin, a yang, a plus, a minus, a positron, electron, and so on and so forth. There are these opposites. And if, in fact, the entire quantum field of the universe is running to decay, in fact, is accelerating to decay, and would end, it's finite. All cosmologists accept, you know, that this universe will one day come to an end in terms of its presentation. It would be just a mass field of total cold nothingness. And that would be it. All matter, all subatomic particles will be unwound and taken apart. And the problem there is, what then is there beyond this? One has to look at the word beyond, because we can look at the word beyond with our minds. Where does the thought come from? How can we think that word beyond, if you like? So this is a really fascinating thing, which brings everyone and their hopes and their fears and their scope and so on in the abstract to be a central question for us all to consider. How is all this possible if the universe is finite and ends? How could our ability to know and understand this decaying universe have grown out of that process of decay? There has to be another process feeding in somewhere, from somewhere, a momentum that pulls the other way. And this is the big, big deal that I began to see when I did my research. There has to be another state of being, something. Call it what you like. I don't like the word universe there, so I call it, out of deference to those people who believe in a God, I call it the Godverse. Any word would do, the Allverse, if you want that in a secular sense, the Godverse. And I think that within that frame of activity and being and existence, so to speak, all things there come together. Our universe, where all things are taken apart, all things come together. Now, if you think about the consequences of this, Randy, you have an awesome thought again in front of you. Good heavens, if we are in this predicament of breakup without condition, if you see what I'm trying to say, yes. In other words, we are going to break up, how do we access this other universe, which by implication, this opposite kind of law thing, how do we access that? And that's where you get religion coming into this equation. So you see, I've gone from UFOs.
Yes, we are coming up on a break here. We're going to take a break at this point. And when we come back, I want to explore this a little bit more. I want to talk a little bit more about mind and consciousness and how we define that. And also the thesis behind this, what we would call the God state, the Godhead, and the universe, which seems to be spinning towards a state of chaos. As you can tell, this is a very complex subject that pulls together a lot of information that comes from very disparate sources. We're going to also talk about the Shroud of Turin. We're going to talk about the gathering of genetic material. We're going to talk about the implications both to abductees themselves and to the general population of on planet Earth. Again, the book is Great Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. You can obtain information about that on the website at nigelkerner.com. It's a book that breaks out a lot of fascinating and interesting theories about this. It weaves together an entire cosmology and also a spiritual background as well that I don't think we can ignore in exploring the ET phenomena. When we come back, we're going to examine a little bit more detail on this. We're going to talk about the Shroud of Turin. We're going to get an interesting view into some things that I don't think we've considered before on the subject of alien abduction. I'm Randy Moggins. This is Exotica. We'll be back after these messages on the V Channel. I'm Randy Moggins, and we're talking with Nigel Kerner, who's the author of the book, Gray Aliens and Harvesting of Souls. And we have with us also on the line Dr. Andrew Silverman and Professor John Biggerstaff. And Nigel, you broke out a major component of your thesis in discussing the state of the universe, entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, and which I take from your book was kind of one of the triggers that led you deeper into this research. You basically have asked, I guess, existential questions about our own existence relative to the existence of these other beings, and it is a very complex background, but it feeds into the questions of why the alien grays are here, why these entities are here, what they are doing and what they are after. So maybe we can just differentiate a little bit here in terms of discussing consciousness and mind and exactly how you define that, because I found the study of consciousness, which I've pursued for over 20 years, to be fascinating, and yet at the same time it's almost been the holy grail to define it.
Yes. Well, you know, once you've got this overall implicate double pole system, the first one is the Godverse, and the other one is, shall we call, its opposite. Godverse, where all things come together in one, and the opposite flow, where everything is taken apart to a almost absolute and virtual state of chaos. You cannot go to the nth of that, really, if you think about it, because you will be cancelling out your own existence in chaotic terms, and chaos itself will cancel itself out, so to speak. So you've got that tendency to adrift towards that other pole, that implicate pole, the two great major stanchions against which all experience happens. And I believe that the universe and universes as such and big bangs as such may well come from the potential difference between these two opposite states. So there are two realities pulling in two opposite directions, Randy. And the Godverse, that is a state of complete union, order, and togetherness, and therefore a non-physical state, as there is no separation of points to make the physical. And the other state is a physical universe of ours, which is the in-between state that happens when the two main components and their potential difference charge a force that makes this happen, and the universe comes out of the center interaction, center interface, interaction of these two things, and amalgamates both things together. And the great thing about this is when the universe begins, and I'm talking pre-universe now, it's a Gnostic idea, really, pre to the universe, so to speak, that state exists forever, budding off universes. And there you get this incredible thing that you can live for. If you can get access into the Godverse, you will, in fact, exist forever. while in the universe, you have a temporary stance, breaking down all the time, but repairing, breaking down and repairing. That's the central stance of the amalgam between the God state and the opposite state of chaos. And of course, the other state, of course, is you drift into complete nothingness if you allow yourself to go into the chaotic pole, the pole of absolute chaos, so to speak. Not quite absolute, by the way. I have to say that again, if you want to be strictly scientific about this, in that sense. So I think Dr. Bickerstaff and Andrew want to come in now on this.
Yes, I've got a little point to make here, which I think is pertinent. When we take the concept of the physics and the observer as part of the whole continuum of the universe, if we then apply that back to cosmology and we look at this concept of the Big Bang theory, essentially, right at the beginning, effectively, there was essentially nothing there if we extrapolate it back. But since atoms themselves, as Andrew pointed out, need to be observed to effectively collapse their function to be real, then in fact, that implies really that consciousness has to be there to create them in the first place. And therefore, at the beginning of the universe, the consciousness that actually generated the universe was there all along. And I think this is a really important point, which we're probably going to come back to when we talk about what these greys and stuff are.
Well, consciousness is really a reflection of the background state of that implied existence of these two poles. It's really the background sheet, if you like, that has to exist in that interaction process between two opposites. And consciousness is that power that is present because these two things interact, so to speak. And we picked this up, but you really have got to come in from the Godverse, the only place you can. And the moment you come in from the Godverse, you come with that background state already, or the perception to see it loaded into your particular sense of your being. I think Andrew wants to come in here.
Yes. Yes, please. I mean, I was just going to actually say that, interesting, I was talking about Schrödinger before, a couple of other things that he said, sorry to keep harking back to it, but that he's had something to say about science in general, and not so much science, but how science is conducted, with this accent on the empiricism, i.e. looking at only what the senses can tell us, and forgetting that there has to be a mind in order to experience those senses. And what he was saying is that we've constructed this artificial, what we call objective world, and imagine somehow that this exists somewhere out there. But if you actually try to define it, it doesn't actually have any of the properties that we experience. For example, if you take the color blue, you can't describe objectively what the color blue looks like, but anyone who is sighted will know what it looks like, anyone who can see. And it's the same with consciousness. We all know what consciousness is because we have it, but then we try to define it in empirical terms, according to defining it in terms of things that can be seen. But by its nature, it's always going to be invisible. But without it, nothing can be seen. And the other thing that he pointed out is that consciousness in any of us, in any sentient being, in any human being, is actually fundamentally the same thing. All that differs is what we are aware of. We have different memories, different experiences. We make different choices. But the fundamental axiom of awareness and of will is the same in everyone, just directed differently. And he came to the conclusion from that it must have originally, and that by our fundamental nature, is that we are all one. And this must be the case, of course, if the universe began as a singularity and we didn't have a beginning in time. And it follows on from that if the, as Nigel says quite rightly, the second law of thermodynamics, as any physicist would know, does break things apart into greater and greater states of chaos. Why then is it just coincidence that the sort of wise teachers that have spoken throughout the centuries to humanity have always had the saying, things like love thy neighbor as thyself? Maybe this is giving us a clue to the fact that fundamentally we're all one, and that if we recognize that, not just in our heads intellectually as an exercise or finding it interesting, but if we really recognize that in how we live, that we cared for other people as much as for ourselves, and saw that anything that happens to them affects us, affects
and you, things you, that happen.
If I hear you correctly, you've basically broken out a primordial cause here, which itself is consciousness, hurling out into a creative field that we might call the universe, the multiverse, the omniverse, whatever you want to
differentiate. Absolutely.
That primordial cause has spun off of itself something that is distinctly conscious and a reflection of itself.
But absolutely. It is it's a background reflection of the duality mixed together. And the essential thing, Randy, is that you have to come from out of it in order to be conscious. So, in a sense, you have to be some entity, if you like, that begins beyond the universe and comes in with the universe. And I call that natural being. And this is how we get to this incredibly, almost arbitrary thing we call a soul. What on earth is a soul? You get so many people jumping up and down in science, soaked in it up to their eyeballs, so to speak, screaming high dudgeon, that there can't be anything called a soul and all this. Well, I think they're very, very, very mistaken in what they see, because to me, a soul is quite simply that connected information field or connection in information, so to speak, that comes in with the universe, with anything that ends up living like us in the universe. So the soul is simply a line of information. It's nothing kind of out there. It's a thing. It is simply that line that identifies you and me. And of course, as Andrew says, we all have a different way of marking our lines, so to speak. That's what makes individuality. And because we are in a physical universe of parts, there is going to be difference. And that's what makes us all different. But the essential and absolutely vital thing is that you've got to see that you've got to come to this point now, contemporary, and be in the self. That's how you identify this thing called self, that differentiation point that is you or me or whatever. And this is a great kind of thing that grabbed me as I was looking at this, trying to explain all this information and put it together over the years and so on, is that we can actually identify then this ourselves. You know, we've got a mum and a dad and a grand and a granddad. We go backwards, right the way connected to that beginning point of the universe. And, of course, if the universe came from somewhere, to a point beyond that, too. And so we've got this fantastic connection all the way down. And it's so important to define this as natural livingness, if you like. We now have got to the stage with the breakup of the universe into a componency we call livingness. We might have been light beings, if you like, if we came through with a fantastically clear information field. But as the second law gripped us, we became more and more, if you like, more solid and separate and so on. And we've now ended up as artifacts we call living being. And the universe, of course, is full of it. And let's say this. We look at this thing and we get this business of God and all the rest of it. It's quite simple. Look, you cannot have an anthropomorphic God. They've just discovered loads and loads, if you like, of planets out there and that have, you know, that have beings. How many old men with white beards on the roof of the Sistine Chapel touching Adam's finger are you going to see are going to be out there? Because everyone will have their own version of a God being.
And isn't that really the heart of religion itself, that it's trying to franchise God rather than finding the unified field behind the creative force, which would be connective rather than fragmented?
Absolutely, Andrew, you said it. And by the way, Andrew, I think, wants to come in here.
Yes.
Yes, please. Just on the fascinating subject, what is it that makes us all discrete as self, as individuals? And to me, if we all came into this universe right at the start, before there was any separation, before there was any time, at the start, it means we must have been all-knowing. We didn't have any limits, because to have limits, you have to have room to be limited, to be separate. You have to have space, you have to have time. To be selfish, you have to be separate. To be separate, you have to make space. So what I would suggest is that, and this is really what I read in a manuscript that he wrote, you know, quite a long time ago, before actually his first book was published and made a lot of sense to me, is that actually what defines an individuality is our individual patterns of restriction. what we don't see, what we don't know. And you can see it shown in human behavior in terms of ignorance that shows its face through selfishness, self-centeredness, lack of empathy, the psychopathic tendency, racism, all of these things that make separation happen and division happen to actually engender the entropic drift to be accelerated, if you like, to make us become more and more limited. And it seems to me that all the great teachers like the Buddha and Jesus and Muhammad and so on were all trying to show people that there's actually another way of living that you can actually bring together through caring that's actually enacted through your life. Yeah. That actually undoes that entropic momentum.
And that,
to me, is a great clue to what we're going to talk about hopefully a bit later about how the shroud mechanism could have worked.
Yeah, and the point is, you see, Randy, that because you come from the Godverse, if you like, where all things are together in a perfect harmonious singularity, right, that point that I call Godhead, if you like, want of a better word again, and here again I stress I'm doing it out of deference to people who, there's so many people who believe in a religion, and I am not against their belief in any religion. I would just simply hope that they would stop and look at this thing rationally and join up the dots, because they will see something wonderful come about, rather than the dogmas and the self-interest that for years have flavored all our lives and perhaps lied to us, you know, in the most awful way, and given despair and all the terrible things sometimes that organized religion does to people, and
yes.
So on.
And I believe, we've got about 10 minutes left in this segment.
Yes.
What you've just set up here gives us a pretty strong framework to begin to discuss the differentiation between consciousness, the created beings that have spun off of the Godhead,
yeah,
and exactly what it is that we're encountering now with the entities themselves that you have proclaimed as being a very strong presence, and I believe we all agree on that. My journey towards this has largely reached many of the same conclusions you have. You just simply put flesh and bones on it, because to me it was simply a knowing.
Yes.
So what I'd like
I would say that is more advanced than my actually putting bones on anything, really. And there are so many people that have this gift of actually being able to sense it and know it. I think that is a far superior thing. But I've got a rather mundane, scientific, list-filing mind, and I had to come at it by putting the flesh on the bones.
This is the work that we have to do. The work that we have to do is to put the flesh and the bones on it, because most of humanity is in denial, and denial is a state of simply ignoring experiential and the scientific background and all of the other things that we've discussed on this show. It's like I said, I had a knowing about this. What we were dealing with in terms of the entities themselves is that, one, they were artificially created beings, or as I came to understand them, synthetic beings, and that they were robotic and probably part of a hive mind. So maybe now you can take that, which was my little hypothesis, and kind of take what we've explored so far in this show and kind of bring us up to speed on what we are dealing with.
I'll try and do that. I mean, I can only make an attempt. Please understand that I don't want to preach new meanings to the world and all the rest of it. It's just been a fantastic adventure following a simple line of logic and having all this break before me. And I think that every single human being can do this for themselves. The problem is other people and things keep telling them, no, you don't think for yourself. We will do your thinking. Mm-hmm. We will put a cross in space and time and admit you here, there, or everywhere. And all this nonsense has been going on for thousands of years, and the great beings that came, the original authors of the great religions, the great Islamic prophet Muhammad, who was completely vilified and things put in his mouth that he never said, the same with Jesus Christ, and the same with the Eastern religion of Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, if you like, of Eastern Yore, and so on. And the point is, somebody has to say, stop. Science is showing us empirically that all this old mumbo-jumbo is gone. It's finished, and we've got to see this now. We've got a fantastic opportunity of building the whole thing without replacing those wonderful factorizations of the past, but by saying why we individually are so important. And I tell you what, Randy, the thing that actually unites it all, and Andrew will talk about this later, is a artifact they have in Turin Cathedral. And I'm really not religious about this, but I tell you what, when I have looked at the science of this, and I actually went to Frascati with Andrew, where he addressed a symposium of the latest researchers on the Shard of Turin, in terms of what this being did there, you have got an affirmation that magnifies every single human being individually, if but each of us realize how powerful and wondrous we once were and could still be, simply because the Godverse is still there in us, and we can speak to this Godverse within us, so to speak. You know, Christ said the kingdom of heaven is within you.
Within you, yes.
And I try to explain this as the space between atomic arrays, and that in the center of each of these points of that space, you will get a point of complete zero. And that zero, with no force in it, is the Godverse itself, the doorway to the Godverse, where all information that there is, every last bit of it, can be accessed. If you can actually get and believe that our minds and our feelings and our attention can actually address this point. Now, how this is done, I will leave to other experts. I'm not a great philosopher on that side of things, but I tell you, we've got, first of all, to define two very important things. One is naturalness, and the other is artificialness. There are two components, two fundamental components, like the two poles I defined earlier. Naturalness and artificialness. Naturalness makes for natural living being in all the planets in the universe. And artificialness is what comes created by those beings or the mechanism of the universe once the universe has been formed, and doesn't come in with it, so to speak, to be that form. We, in other words, are connected up as natural beings to the beginning and beyond. But we can make a robot and give it a kind of intelligence, and that would be a created symposium.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the distinction we've got to make. And all the trouble comes if we make such a thing and don't know how to define the difference between the two for the thing that we have created to see. Because that thing can never see that. It would be a paradox to it. So if you give artificial intelligence to a created robot, you, I, and the physical universe and all natural being is in big trouble indeed. And this is how I will define how soul and all the rest of it comes together as we go along. I think maybe Andrew and John would like to come in on that.
Sure, please. Hello?
Hi. Hello?
Yes.
Well, I thought that I was signaling he wanted to come in, that's all.
Oh, okay.
Yes, sorry, I thought you said John wanted to come in, so waiting for John. Yeah, I was just going to come back onto the subject of the Turin Shroud, if this is an appropriate time to do so.
Sure, please.
In terms of what we were saying about the evidence for there being something much more to humanity than we would normally give credit to in science, at least. And to do so, I'd like to I'd have to start by saying a little bit about it for those listeners who aren't too familiar with it. It's a 14-foot long piece of cloth which has on it the imprint of a man in photographic negative, that's only on the surface fibers of the cloth, with no painting on it at all. And the first words I have to get out of the way are carbon dating, because many listeners will, of course, have heard about this 1988 report that it was carbon dated to have been medieval. And some people even think it was made by Leonardo, which is interesting, since Leonardo was only born 100 years after the date that the carbon date came in on. But the thing is that carbon dating was shown by some wonderful research by a couple of people called Benford and Marino to have been got wrong, because it was a part of the cloth that with sonar data that was actually dated. But I think Nigel wants to come in here, and this is something that I'll return to later.
Can I? What I think I'd like to do is I'd like to reserve the Shroud of Turin topic for the next segment, because we're coming up on about a minute and a half here, and that's going to take a little bit more time as well.
Yeah.
So to kind of, maybe if I can reframe a little bit what we've gotten in this segment, you've made some very strong foundations for the creation of the universe and where that's come from and consciousness. And again, for the listeners, this book details with a lot of specificity what has been presented on this program. Nigel lays out an entire map with, I believe, a very excellent framework to understand consciousness, what we would call the Godhead, what we would call the universe, what we would call two states of being, one being the Godverse itself, and the other being the chaotic state, which becomes the created universe. And these are important distinctions to understand. What we're going to do on the next show is we're going to break this out a little bit more, and we're going to look at these beings that we call the entities, the ETs, the aliens, and we're going to begin to understand why they are different, why they are seeking to tap into something that's distinctly part of the creation we call the human, and how that plays into this whole understanding of our own physical being and our own spiritual destiny and what it is thereafter. We're going to do all of that when we come back on the next installment of Exotica with our guests, Nigel Koerner, Dr. Andrew Silverman, and Professor John Biggerstaff.
The supernatural.